The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events.
I'm looking for the reliable. I'm looking for the trustworthy. I'm looking for the tried and tested and true, the timeless. I'm looking for the definitive measure of value, the bedrock of knowledge. I want a reference point that doesn't require batteries. Perhaps this is why I'm so comfortable with gold. Gold in the monetary and financial sphere is a bedrock.
Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. We're just getting you back, Dave, from New York, but it certainly wasn't without some difficulties. And I want to talk about that in a little bit, but what a week while you were gone. I mean, the Chinese situation, the Greek situation. Let me ask you, starting with China, these guys are intervening like mad right now to keep this market from going down. Is there only one direction that's allowed in China, and that is up?
Well, that appears to be the course. And what you really have to ask is, what is at stake? Is it revolution that they fear? And I think whenever you look at China and the potential for instability, you're dealing with a very small number of people at the top, whether it's the 9-member Politburo or, you know, a slightly larger cadre in terms of the membership within the party. They're still a fraction of the society at large. And, you know, when you look at the needs of the state in terms of maintaining control, you realize just how close they are to revolution. We mentioned this a number of years ago, that on average, they have close to 70,000 social disturbances and riots each year. 70,000. And this is a conversation that we had with Min Jinping and a couple of other people who spent a good bit of time in China. And they're always concerned with social stability and the fear of revolution.
Well, and you have an awful lot of people who would either be on the farm or be in the cities, maybe very hungry, that have been day trading, and they've been getting sort of the quick, easy hit on the stock market that's just been flying over the last year. I think when you talk about a small group of people in power over an extremely large group of people that could become unsettled, I think of the dynamic like in a prison, where you have very few guards, and one of the key elements of maintaining control is to keep the perception that the people could not unite and overwhelm them. There was a great movie, a true story, called Escape from Sobibor, about a group of Russians that were brought into a concentration camp during World War II. And the commander of the Russians, who had been brought into captivity, understood that they could overpower the guards. There was a certain amount that would be lost. They knew that there was going to be certain losses during that time, but they actually were able to escape by overpowering the guards. And once the people in any civilization understand that they can overthrow that power, like France in the late 1800s, you can have something change radically.
I'm reading a book on that right now, dealing with deterrence theory, and where, you know, basically the threat of force is sufficient and the threat of destruction is sufficient to control the diplomatic process. And it's one of the ideas that's explored. And of course, we're talking about internal, in our conversation about China, an internal dynamic. And I guess you could bring in the element of carrot and stick. There's times which you have to be very forceful. We mentioned that last week, there's been a number of people arrested for shorting the market, for suggesting that there's reasons to short the market, as being essentially the dilettantes within the Chinese culture who are stirring things up, so to say. And if they're a source of instability for the stock market, it's very easy to solve that problem. Eliminate them from the environment, from the milieu, and don't allow them to make those threats, write online articles, et cetera, saying why the stock market could potentially go down. Keep in mind that the stock market in China started at a price earnings multiple when it was at its peak just in June of about 140. So that's 140 years worth of earnings packed into the current price. And right now it's more reasonably priced at 60, which is still about 4 to 5 times what you would expect of normal. And that's what makes the intervention so extreme, is you're intervening at four or five times multiple of what would be considered a normal or sustainable level. Why the government has drawn the line in the sand and decided to push the market up from these levels, I think it does come back to the fear of revolution and something that is more cultural in terms of their concern and not really related to market dynamics, so to say. It's really what can come out of the market dynamics that they fear.
Well, and I found it strange that our stock market shut down for several hours when this crisis was occurring in China. Now, I want to talk about that because you were directly affected. Your travel was affected. The markets were affected. And frankly, even your ability to get information from the Wall Street Journal would have been affected. So I'd like you to tell the story of last week, just your travel and how it personally affected you.
Sure. And, you know, through the weekend, just before we get there, it's that, you know, whether it is China and there being a subtext to the story, a feared revolution, or Greece, where we're talking about, again, tens of billions of euros being discussed as a solution to the problem. I just want to remind you that this is the third proposed bailout. It's proposed at this point. It hasn't been agreed on. But you're dealing with triple the problem. We had a problem which was just over $100 billion problem 6 or 7 years ago. Now, we have no solution. We're on to the third bailout. And instead of a $100 billion problem, it's about a $300 to a $340 billion problem. What happens each time is that the powers that be attempt to do the same thing, quite frankly, that's happening in China, which is ease the concerns of the people on the street and take the panic level, quote unquote, off the boil and bring a sense of calm back into the marketplace. Now, they're not fixing anything. The structural issues which got them there, they're actually compounding. We discussed that last week by saying, you know, the average household debt obligation is about $20,000. And you look at a $40,000 figure being a reality, just compounding that debt negatively over the next 10 years. Now, if you introduce a new bailout, all you're doing is layering in even more debt onto an economy that is having a hard time paying its existing debt. So, I mean, you begin to see the insanity of any proposal when the existing debt can't be paid. But the solution to that debt problem is just to layer on more debt. And this passes as an intelligent solution. Now, why it's intelligent from a political standpoint is that it avoids revolution. It avoids conflict in the street. It avoids panic. It avoids violence.
It's another element of this deterrence theory. It's just basically kicking the can down the road.
But in point of fact, all you're doing is compounding and increasing the likelihood of something far more violent down the road.
It's my children's problem, not my own. That's really the way they're answering the question.
Right. And what happens when your children not only face the economic realities that you left them to, but then deal with an intergenerational resentment, having been saddled with major obligations that can't be paid? Again, it's the kind of thing that goes from rending a societal fabric to even rending a familial fabric, the most basic unit of the society. So, I mean, I think there's a huge amount at stake in Greece. And this goes to a quote, Gideon Rachman in this week's Financial Times quotes Karl Marx. He says, "History repeats itself first as tragedy and second as farce." Mm. The last bailout was a tragedy because it was compounding silliness on silliness, unsustainable numbers on unsustainable numbers. Now it's farce. And it really is interesting that the world equity markets somehow return to calm in the face of something that is completely farcical.
Well, I think we need to remember when the people who are in power, like you talked about in China, or in the euro, or even here in the United States, they want to maintain the perception of control and normalcy, and they'll do literally anything to keep it. Now, this is what's going to take me to the market shutdown, because too suspicious for me, Dave. It just happened to be timed right as we were 200 points down here in New York, and China was melting down.
I was traveling to New York City last week, and I sat in the airport for about 4 hours I was reminded of both the benefits and the costs of technological dependence. And it was funny. I called the United help desk at 6:30 in the morning to inquire about our 6 o'clock departure, as I knew I was going to miss a very close connection in Denver. And the person assisting me said this, "I show that your flight is on time. There's no problem with your connection in Denver." And I reminded her of what the current time was and that we were already half an hour late, and that I was going to miss that second flight. And that didn't deter her. She just repeated, I see no problem with your flights today. That's what my screen tells me. And so at this point, I just sort of cordially said goodbye, realizing there was nothing more that she could tell me and nothing more she could help me with.
Right, because the screen always tells her the truth.
Well, and isn't this interesting? Reality is not defined by what you see on a screen. When you read something, you need to critically analyze the source. You need to look at the argument. You need to consider the motivation in reporting from a particular perspective. Just because it shows up on a screen does not mean it's true, does not mean it's clean, does not mean it has any basis in fact. Or if it does have a basis in fact, then you have to consider the possibility that there's a little bit of fact and a lot of fiction to go with it. Sometimes what you find on the screen can even turn out to be comical. I mean, imagine a text message that reads, I'm having significant wife issues today. Can you stop by and fix them? And then realize that wife could be, have you ever had something auto-spelled in your text messages? Wi-Fi switched for wife.
You got to be careful with those. Yeah, yeah.
Exactly. I have no problems with my wife. It was just my Wi-Fi.
Yeah.
But it's a very different message. And what you see on the screen can lead you to believe one thing and even begin to say, oh, what's wrong with them? What's going on in their relationship? That's not what was intended to begin with. What's on the screen does not define reality. I mean, come on, I can go to a Bloomberg monitor and I can get a quote on a particular stock or bond, and the current price doesn't tell me everything I need to know. Reality is deeper than that. Sometimes it's hidden under layers of complexity. Sometimes it's intentionally obscured. We've talked about financial engineering and that being sort of the order of the day amongst CFOs and publicly traded companies today. You know, 10 minutes after my encounter with the, I'll call it the helpless desk at United, over the PA in the airport, there's an announcement that there's been a system-wide failure of the United reservation and check-in platform. It's done, and they're working on it, solving it, et cetera, et cetera. So while we're stuck in the airport, later that day, Bloomberg sends a notice to my phone that the New York Stock Exchange has had an unsolvable glitch, and trading is being suspended. And, you know, I mean, again, maybe it's coincidence, but I'm already sort of hypersensitized to computer glitches on a day where I was expecting to be going through the Frick collection that afternoon before dinner with my wife, and we were not going to go to the museum. We might not make it to dinner. We might not make it to New York at all because we're still stuck in the airport. So here comes the New York Stock Exchange market is closed notice, and I'm thinking, oh, this is curious.
Did you feel like there was a connection at the time, or did it just feel like two random events?
Well, I mean, there's a part of me that holds some level of suspicion about things like that.
Yeah.
1 hour stretched to two and then to three. And, you know, the curious thing is that your dark pools and your off-exchange settlement of trades continued for institutions. Your regular trading platforms were frozen.
Hmm.
So, for instance, if you wanted to go to Charles Schwab and try to place a trade, New York Stock Exchange is not functional. You're not placing a trade. But if you're an institution, you can still place a block trade into a dark pool and have it settled. And that's interesting to me just in terms of new dynamics and there being sort of a two-tiered system.
It's a privileged market is what it is.
Yeah, well, that's one of the things that you can learn from it.
But don't they have backups? I mean, the New York Stock Exchange, Chicago, I mean, these major trading exchanges, why don't they have a backup?
That's interesting and curious to me as well, because the Chicago backup systems for the NYSE, New York Stock Exchange, they were never turned on. And I don't know why. Hmm. I still don't know. But when a backup generator is supposed to turn on, when the power fails and it doesn't, it's worth exploring why it didn't. And there may be a reason. May have been a deliberate choice to leave them off as opposed to a failure of the system to automatically engage. But there's other questions. Why was it not engaged? Were the New York Stock Exchange quotes inaccurate? Was there something impacting the data feeds such that the data, although it was flowing, was considered unreliable? It was a good day for the dark pools, not so good for NYSE.
Dave, I talked to one of your analysts over at McIlvany Wealth Management, and he's got a little sarcastic side to him, and I just asked
him
about it.
Which one of them?
Should I name Gavin or not? But Gavin goes, would this have been cut off if the market was up 200 points, or could it have only happened when the market was in free fall down 200? It was a straight line down.
Well, right. So you've got issues in China, which are playing out in real time. You've got the U.S. stock exchange, which is off close to 200 points, as you mentioned. And again, maybe it's just a bad day. When it rains, it pours. You know, when you read one obituary of a famous person, you know that within 7 days, there's going to be two more because they all seem to die in threes.
Oh, you're dark, Dave. You're dark.
So here we have the NYSE, we have United, and lo and behold, the Wall Street Journal has problems on the same day. And yes, there's significant glitches. Maybe it's mere coincidence, but it's worth pondering. And I think this is what is particularly worth pondering. What areas in your life are dependent on technology?
Yeah.
Can you drive across town without using your phone's GPS? You realize there's a whole part of your brain and normal functioning, which given the advancement in technology has for many years, for most of us, right, simply been turned off. I mean, I remember in college out in the Los Angeles area, we had these huge books. I think they were called Thomas Guides, if I remember correctly. And you could navigate anywhere to any neighborhood. And when you were in the wrong neighborhood, you really wanted your Thomas Guide to know, I'm at point A. How do I get to point X, Y, or Z? Get me the heck out of here. And what's the fastest way? That's the sprawling Los Angeles metropolis.
Right.
You did need to know how to read a map.
Right.
Today, you just have to have a smartphone.
Well, and Dave, we've been in that situation. I remember being in Zurich with you, and there was no way to drive around Zurich without a GPS. I mean, it had been laid out hundreds and hundreds of years ago. Cars were not even thought about when that city was laid out. I'm sure Boston's like that. So if a person is visiting or a foreigner to a particular city, these days, yeah, the GPS is actually how most of us get there.
Right. Well, I guess it just underscores this point of the idiocy of a smartphone being what it creates in us as we become more and more dependent
on
them. Exactly, because it does the work for us. And there are other areas of dependence you might note. I mean, is your daily news information, is it all online? Can you even recall those black residue marks on your fingertips when you used to page through the daily paper? Or like we do around here, maybe five of them.
Right.
Anyway, I thought it was interesting. The market did shut down in a context, and perhaps it's irrelevant, but you've got Chinese equities, which are under pressure and still are. The Dow was down over 200 points. Then a technical glitch occurs. I mentioned to my wife the significance of canceling all standing orders, because that's what happened when they shut down the market. They canceled all outstanding orders. And that was actually the most significant data feed onto my phone from Bloomberg.
Well, and those orders, there was nothing looking like the market was going to go up when this thing was canceled. Like I said before, these orders were canceled. I wonder how many outstanding orders were further sale orders.
Well, my first comment to Mary Catherine was, imagine having a stop loss order in place. You know, if price is going down in an asset that you own and you want out at a certain price, that stop loss order gets triggered at a certain price. But lo and behold, you know, imagine the market approaches that trigger price, market closes. Then all of a sudden your order is canceled. You would have been additional downside volume and probably would have pushed the price even further to the downside. And yet, here we are with outstanding orders canceled, both to buy and to sell. So yes, you can simply go in and replace your order. It's no big deal. To me, it feels like a circuit breaker. It feels like a circuit breaker. Here's where I would, as an investor and anyone who's listening who has a dollar in the market, keep this in mind. Don't be surprised by the same kind of event on a very bad day when the Dow's selling off 100 points, 300 points, 600 points, the market temporarily closes. For whatever the reason is, just understand that when things happen and it's happened to you before, you're less sensitive to it. So the second or third or fourth time you've got this glitch, it's an update, just like the last update that we did to our software package. It needed to be done because there's more high frequency traders. And so we're improving to accommodate, et cetera, et cetera. Whatever the malarkey is that's given to explain and soothe the nerves of market participants, realize that there is a certain degree of conditioning occurring. And as that conditioning occurs, I think you move forward, let's say, September to October timeframe. That's the time frame in which most markets sell off. If you're looking at sort of the great catastrophic declines in the U.S. market.
Right.
But lo and behold, we have an investment population, netizens, if you will, only aware of what happens in the world of the net and what's given to them in digital portals.
Well, and you're assuming human actors, but you know, Dave, I remember being in New York a couple of years ago when Bloomberg announced that they had a new algorithmic trading program that they were selling to the brokers that actually trades on good news and bad news and news stories. And I thought, gosh, that sounds like a feedback loop. It sounds like Bloomberg is actually doing the news, and then they're selling algorithmic trading programs that trade on the keywords on the news that Bloomberg actually produces.
Isn't that curious? Well, that is an issue when you look at the headlines, because you can ask two questions. Number one, what does the headline mean?
Right.
And number two, what you're suggesting, what is the headline meant to do? So yeah, we have the trading algorithms that are tied to headlines and news feeds, and you are talking about an automatic deployment of capital, investments which are automatically made by supercomputers on the basis of those headlines. So we're told, let's take, for instance, last Friday and this Monday, that a bailout deal has been reached in Greece. Markets instantly rallied.
Instantly, within nanoseconds.
Yeah.
Dave.
But was it true or false? Well, it was false. There was no bailout deal that had been reached. The German government hasn't even received the parliamentary mandate to open negotiations with Greece.
But the word triggered the algorithm.
That's right. And that same issue of parliamentary permission has yet to occur with the Dutch and the Austrians and several other countries within the Eurozone as well. The offer on the table is essentially, right now, you implement the austerity we told you to and have told you to for months, and then we can have a conversation about some form of a lifeline, which could be upwards of 89 billion euros. Mm-hmm. The only commitments made thus far is to start talks on a conditional basis, and it may include X, Y, and Z. May include X, Y, and Z. So the promises are iffy, but you have to, right now, go ahead and put money on the barrel. That is specifically $50 billion of assets on the barrel. It's almost like in a game of poker, do you have the money to play at this table? You put $50 billion on the table, and then we'll talk about $89 billion and the potential of even playing the game.
Well, Dave, let's go back to this deterrence theory, where the people who are managing and trying to control the larger picture are actually trying to deter things from going any other direction but what they've planned. You know, Spiros, the Greek prime minister, who was voted in with a no vote on austerity, seems to have made an about face this week. Now, that also seemed strange. It's a week of strange occurrences and coincidences. Is there something behind the curtain there?
I don't know. I don't know that we will know, but I think it's worth, as an intelligent humanoid, thinking about it and trying to figure out what happened this week and is there any similarity to events in the future. What happened in Greece? I don't know if Spiros was threatened, if this is sort of a scare tactic for other European countries, where maybe you've got populist trends in France, for instance, and you need to send a very clear message. The populist trend in Greece is being crushed, and if you want to pursue a populist mandate in Italy or Spain or France, it will not end well for you. Exhibit A being Spiros, who were in the process of crucifying politically. Again, what was happening behind the scenes? I don't know. But how do you go from being a hard-edged, in-your-face, Greek dilettante prime minister to a compliant, yes, sir, may I have another European politician?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this happened in a matter of days. And wouldn't you love to know what was put on the table over the weekend?
You mean the table in the smoke-filled room that no one could see?
Well, yeah. Political acquiescence of this sort, what it does suggest is threats and coercion. It also suggests that Europe would like to, as I mentioned earlier, crucify a populist representative in order to send a message to other would-be populists in Europe. We will break you, is the message.
Well, let me ask, though, because the Greeks voted against austerity. I mean, that vote is only a week and a half old, and yet, don't the Greeks have to agree to austerity, even to come back to the table to get any of this bailout money?
Well, that's right. So Spiros comes back to get a mandate from the people. He's given a mandate. He goes back to the Brussels meeting rooms, and what happens next? An about face from what the people told him to do. What happens next? It's anyone's guess. But to agree to austerity measures is what opens the talks to the bailout. And again, back to this issue of headlines, and many of these headlines being fallacious. This is from Yahoo Finance. Global stocks rise after Greece agrees to new bailout.
Mm.
Dow up nearly 180 points.
That's that circular system we talked about, okay, where you have these news points that come out and things just react to surface news. They're not really fully true.
It is a circular system of price reinforcement. It is a form of gaming the system and manipulation, and it continues on the basis of misleading headlines. And the average guy who doesn't have the time to read any deeper than a headline is going to say, hey, you know, everything's fine, Greece, they finally figured it out. You know, we reached a point of terminus last week and saner minds prevailed. I don't know that saner minds prevailed. We haven't agreed to anything. Mm-hmm. We have negotiations which may be entered into, which will take 3 to 5 weeks. And trust you me, I mean, the headlines in that kind of time frame, it's going to give traders ample opportunity to play games, even as fundamentals continue to deteriorate, both here in the U.S., our markets, but also in the European and global economy. You've got the IMF, you've got the BIS, the Bank of International Settlements, which agree there's concerns about sort of slippage in the economy. I don't know if you saw this, Claudio Borio, in a recent report from the Bank of International Settlements. He's head of economic research at the BIS. He says, look, we've got ultra-low interest rates, which may be feeding economic weakness by destabilizing financial markets. In short, low rates beget lower rates, the BIS in this report is how they conclude. And what he's basically asking is, are central banks really doing their job? And are interest rates at these low levels consistent with what the market needs to actually allocate assets effectively? And he's saying, no, absolutely not. We're in a dangerous position. The mandate that the central banks have put into place, errant to begin with, is not really working. So what do you find in Greece in response to a troubled set of circumstances? Why don't we just spend a little bit more money that we don't have to solve a problem?
So Dave, when someone dies on an operating table, a lot of times they get those electronic pads out and they put it on the heart and go, poof, you know, and it supposedly revives the heart, or that's what it's supposed to do. But it seems like for the last at least 4 years, that's what they've been doing. They've been basically popping that heart over and over and over with low interest rates, with quantitative easing, all these emergency operating room measures.
But what we're really talking about is the problem of the 800-pound man. If you want to know why there's a heart problem, you can revive and revive and revive. But the problem with the 800-pound man is a systemic problem. It's a systemic problem. That's not to say it's not complex. There may be many elements to it, from diet to psychology to environment to, you know, environmental factors, you name it.
But it's a longevity issue, and the longevity of an 800-pound man is much shorter than someone who's maybe better shape.
You know, this week we had the ex-finance minister of Finland saying that Greece is now under custody. And it's eerie when the Eurozone insists that in order to have a conversation about another $89 billion in extended loans, they're asking for 25%, the equivalent of 25% of Greece's GDP up front as an asset placement. Almost like, you give us $50 billion in assets, we'll give you $89 billion in debt. So it's a secured loan. It's a more secured loan. And the reality is, they did something similar to this in the last bailout, and it was supposed to be a very high figure, not quite $50 billion, and they've only raised three in the process of selling off state assets. It's not happening. And I think what people don't realize is that it's kind of all smoke and mirrors. Everyone's pretending and everyone's assuming that if we just extend and pretend, everything's going to work out all right. Listen, when I think about debt, when I think about default, when I think about forgiveness, I want to be very clear on this point, because my analysis is pragmatic. This has nothing to do with sort of having moral girders to it. Do I think people should pay their debts? Yes, I do. But pragmatically, do I see a reason for Greece to default? Absolutely. At the level of pragmatism, and I draw on Lex Riefel's book, Restructuring Sovereign Debt. It's an amazing book. And here's what you know from market history. Markets forget past failure very quickly. It is not a default that Euro politicians are concerned about. It's not a financial event which Euro politicians are concerned about. It's the dissolution of the Eurozone, with Greece being the first olive out of the jar.
Well, it's who ends up actually paying the debt, because in a default like this, the predator creditor, like what we see in Europe, okay, where you have the Germans knowing full well what they're doing when they're originally giving a loan to Greece, knowing that it's not going to get paid back. Or like here in America, where a bank knows they're giving a mortgage to somebody who literally cannot pay that debt back, but they know that someone's got their back. Now, with that being the case, they don't want to end up losing money, even with a bad debt.
I think it goes beyond that to the political side of things, where, again, whatever the cost is, I mean, if you just expunged all of Greece's debt, $200 to $300 billion worth of debt, it's going to hurt somebody. But it's not, in the end, that big of a deal.
Until you add Spain, Portugal, France, everybody else who sees that happen.
Right. And then what you have is the dissolution of a political union. Not quite right. Political union, not quite fiscal union, not quite anything. What is the Eurozone? It is a political body without a political mandate, without a fiscal mooring. And again, it comes back to this issue of, you know, can Greece leave the monetary union and still be a part of the EZ, the Eurozone? Probably it can, and probably it should. And we talked about that last week. We don't need to reiterate it again. That I think the concern is a political one. Because again, if you're looking at it from a pragmatic standpoint, the clearest way towards Greece's economic recovery, if you cared about Greece's economic recovery, wanted to see where they were 10 or 20 years from now in a growing and thriving economy, remove the burden of debt. Remove it. Don't multiply it. Don't compound it. And all adding $89 billion or however much they may eventually add to it, it does nothing towards solving the problem. Latin America is a perfect set of case studies for how you move towards a growth path and away from, again, what was unsustainable encumbrance to begin with. Get rid of it. Get rid of it. Does it hurt creditors? Absolutely. In my opinion, who cares?
You know, I want to shift back for a little bit on reliance to technology because, you know, when we talked to Nazli Chowkhry, she analyzed this new environment of the internet and how it's going to have to either be controlled or she gave various scenarios as to how the future of the internet's going to move. And we have something that's outside of our paradigm that's occurred in the last month, Dave, that just keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger. You know, you've got 4.2 million personnel files that had been grabbed that now they've said, well, it really wasn't 4.2 million personnel files. I'm talking, this has got information about everything, okay? Private information. Now they're saying it's over 20 million.
That's right. 22 million U.S. government personnel files, including information about immediate family members, residents, social security numbers, educational history, personal and business acquaintances, health records, criminal history, if there is any.
Things you don't mind sharing with your friends.
Financial history. Have you ever declared bankruptcy? What is your current state of financial wherewithal? I mean, this is the issue. We are seeing things unfold that I think could play very poorly in terms of our rights as individuals and freedoms as a country. Why? Because as we mentioned earlier, when I sit in a Denver airport, the only thing that's happening is I'm inconvenienced by a few hours. And I think to myself, I wish the system worked better. And if somebody came along and said, well, I can fix the system and make it better, for the sake of convenience, I might give them a green light or a thumbs up. But when you combine the issue of desire for greater convenience and desire for greater security in a world that's dependent on the internet,
right,
I think all of a sudden there are some very complex issues which we have to deal with. We tried to open that conversation with Nazli Chowkhry last December, and you look at what just happened, 22.1 million U.S. government personnel files disappearing, being in the hands of an unknown state or non-state actor. This is a treasure trove which during the Cold War would have been considered a sufficient shift in the balance of power between sort of the communist bloc and the free world to change the outcome of the Cold War.
Even before the Cold War, I mean, any kind of dictatorial system understands the power of information. The KGB was one of those groups, but the Gestapo and the SS during World War II, Hitler was manic in many ways, but he was also manic about gathering data on people. Now, who has that information, Dave?
I have a very good friend in the security complex back in Washington, D.C., dealing with IT and IT security. Hmm. It's interesting because there's, just like the volatility index measures the volume of puts and calls and tells you who's concerned or not concerned in the stock market, what we've seen is sort of a yawn as different things have happened around the world, major macroeconomic headwinds, and people just continue to yawn. The same thing's happening on this issue, 22.1 million U.S. government personnel files absconded with, and what's the concern level? amongst the security and IT community, it's virtually silent. Nothing's happening. Nobody cares. I mean, if you can imagine, I had this conversation with this gentleman. It's like pretending that Pearl Harbor was a non-event. And that's, I mean, just a couple of ships. Don't worry about
Nothing to see here, folks. Just move on.
You know, feeding the sharks. Don't worry about it. It's not a big deal. And the main reason I'm concerned is you look at Catherine Archuleta's first comments or some of her first comments in response to this. This is the director of the Office of Personnel Management. And she says, right now, there's no evidence of criminal usage with the stolen material. Where would you have that evidence?
Right. We don't even know who has it.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, so when you say stupid things in response to crisis, your credibility goes way down. And I would encourage listeners to revisit the conversation that we had in December with Nazli Chuchri dealing with internet security and control. It's in the weekly commentary archives.
Well, you know, Dave, all weekend long, I was just contemplating and pondering the power of the word. You know, you look in the Bible and all of creation is a word. Jesus is called the word. Words have so much power. And I think of what we were talking about with Bloomberg. Okay. Selling an algorithmic system that takes just single words and single phrases and turns them into major block trades on the stock market, either buying or selling based on the understanding of that word.
The implied meaning.
Yeah. Now, you told me something last night that's intriguing that isn't going to tell anyone the direction of the market for the next year. Okay. So for the person who's really just waiting for the timing signals on the market, you're going to have to put that aside, but enjoy with David what he purchased in New York, because you do, you have this way of treasuring certain things for the right reasons. But it's not necessarily always a good monetary investment choice, is it?
I invested in something this past week knowing that I would lose money. Knowing that I would lose money. And it still, to me, seemed like a smart move. And, you know, when I looked at it, the fundamental value to me is apparent. But arguing against the purchase was the technicals and the price action, which are awful. I mean, the price is in free fall. What you see is not what you get in this case. And I was looking for comparables on price on the asset in question and couldn't find any. It's a very scarce item. So the final decision came down to recognizing the bedrock nature of the asset. And again, here's what's sort of stacked up against it. I was looking at the changes in technology. And this is not a buggy whip type purchase, not to me anyways.
But it doesn't come with batteries either.
Exactly. Right. But in the modern digital era, it's cumbersome, it's slow, it's irrelevant. Who needs it? Also stacking up against the purchase was looking at the current market's decline. And again, it's an asset whose price is in free fall. You know, you've got bear market dynamics, you have no buyers, no interest. Where is the bid? The price has been falling for the last 3 to 5 years consistently. The decline has been well over 50%. And if you define a bear market as a decline of over 20%, you've got one. You've got a bear market in this asset. And I think the last thing was that looking at a shrinking market that is in a shrinking audience, it is a strange and idiosyncratic asset to begin with. And in all likelihood, I won't be getting my money out of it.
Well, and you're probably not even recommending other people go buy it, which a lot of the investments that you buy, Dave, that's part of your job is to recommend that you go buy it. Yeah, but this one, you're probably going to call a personal choice.
So why do I consider it a smart move? Well, I think the asset is foundational to other things. And the asset has stood the test of time as a source of value, even though its price does not reflect it today. And you could say, well, if the price is going down, obviously the vast majority of people would say it doesn't have value, and you're wrong. The vote of the market discounts the basic qualities that I believe are actually important.
All right. Now, by this time in the conversation last night, Dave, I was curious because I had no idea what you were talking about, but there's a store in New York that you turned me on to years ago when I had moved my daughter to New York. And it's hard not to go in there because there are treasures all over the place. You just have to take the time and have the appreciation of something called a book.
I walked through a shop in downtown Manhattan, considering an addition to the portfolio, in this case to our library. And as my wife and I have had many sort of long and detailed conversations about legacy, what we desire to craft for future generations, when I saw this, it seemed like a no-brainer to me. But, you know, out of deference to my wife, our relationship, et cetera, et cetera.
And the money in your pocket.
Exactly. I wanted to check in with Mary Catherine just the same. And no surprise, she overwhelmingly agreed. What is it? It's the first edition of an Oxford English dictionary. 1933 was the print, 13 volumes with 4 volumes to supplement it, which were printed in 1971. I have always wanted to own the 2-volume set, and that is with the magnifying glass. What they've done is they compiled and condensed all of it into 2 volumes. The problem is it's sort of a microfiche encounter. You've got these miniature fonts, which completely annoy me. It's very unusable. If you lose your magnifying glass, you might as well use the books for kindling. You cannot read it without the help of a microscope, practically.
I've tried that before. I've got books that are in that micro print, and you never get them out again. So I'm glad you didn't do that.
But what I like about it is it's the comprehensive, definitive work on the English language.
Right.
It's the basis for everything else.
But you got the full-size version.
When you're building a library, and I think this concept, it's inspired by our friend Russell Napier, who's developed the Library of Mistakes in Edinburgh, Scotland. It's also, I think, borrowing from and inspired by Umberto Eco's 30,000-volume collection. If I took a gander back further in time, you might even say the early North African libraries, which were sort of, it defined the learning centers of those eras.
Like Alexandria.
Exactly. Yeah. But then fast forward to this day where books are going the way of the dodo bird.
Sure. We've got Wikipedia. We've got what we need online anytime we need it, Dave.
And apparently, the Oxford English Dictionary is also going the way of the dodo bird. Prices of the 1989 version, this is a 20-volume cloth set, have dropped 54% on the secondhand market. And if you want to order it direct from the Oxford printers, it's selling at a 60% discount off of the retail sticker. Listen, I understand this is not cutting-edge technology, but what is it? It's 65,000 printed entries in 17 volumes with the history and the evolving usage of each word in the English language. It's like gold to me. It's the basis for everything else. How do you build a library without a dictionary? And we're talking about the dictionary. This is a process that started in 1857 and was not completed until the 1920s. And even then, it hadn't been printed in hardback version until 1933. What was happening in 1933? You've got the world's financial markets, which are falling apart. London is a mess. New York is a mess. We're in the middle of a banking crisis. Gold is confiscated in 33.
Standard Oil. That's when they made their mark in the Middle East.
And this monumental achievement was being published in hardback, leather-bound, beautiful, blue, Moroccan leather. My set, the set that I bought at the Strand, was the personal copy of the U.S. president of the Oxford University Press. It's in perfect condition. The price is in decline. Am I concerned about losing money? Or do I appreciate its variegated value, its foundational role in our family library, the impact that it has in terms of the life of the mind within our family? And do I, in turn, apply a certain discount to the market appraisal, the judgment of this set as irrelevant? I walked to the back of the bookstore, and there was the 20-volume cloth-bound book set up high. There was a gentleman there. I'll just say his name was Ryan. I forget his name exactly. And I said, I'm just curious, how much is that 20-volume set? And he said, well, and there was a look of pain almost mixed with anger in his eye. And he said, well, it's not right. We've had it far too long, and we've just had to discount it again. And they had dropped their price by half on the cloth-bound version. He looked at me and he said, but if you're really interested, you need to go up to our rare book section. Because, and again, he had this pained and angry look on his face. There's the 17-volume set from 1933.
This is the leather-bound.
And it's leather-bound, and it's only a few $100 more than the cloth-bound. Well, only if you're interested. I said, I'll go look.
You had told me that this guy had told you that he would go up and just thumb through it, just enjoying. This is a bibliophile for sure.
Absolutely. And I mean, yes, the price is in decline, but I'm asking the question about what value does the process of learning have? And is there added value in the search, the hunt, through these leather-bound books?
Yeah, because you can get this online, Dave. You just pay, I think they have a fee that you pay every year, but you can get the Oxford English Dictionary online anytime.
$250 a year will get you a subscription to this database, and you can search any word at your convenience on any mobile device. For as long as the lines are up and you are, in fact, online, and again, hearkening back to
United Airlines,
United
the, New
Airlines the New York Stock Exchange,
Wall Street Journal.
You hope that you're online when you need to be online. And I think there's a basic insecurity that I have, Kevin, about the stability of the system as we know it. And I think of Joseph Tainter's book, The Collapse of Complex Societies. We have these huge areas of dependence, and we assume that we will always have the market. The status quo will always be maintained and maintainable. There can be glitches in the system which cause for those dependent relationships to all of a sudden compromise vast amounts of data, which was critical to normal functioning. Well, I'm asking a question about our family library, which is a little bit different, I understand. But I want to make sure that it's rooted and grounded
right. And
not dependent in the wrong ways.
Yeah, you know, David, a few weeks ago, we had a discussion of Bitcoin and gold. And gold obviously has its merits. We don't have to go through that again. Bitcoin, we had a lot of responses from people who said, now, wait a second, when technology goes down, what about your Bitcoin? And they're absolutely right. Bitcoin is an interesting concept, but it's still incredibly dependent on the system.
Right. So, you know, at the end of the year, what do I have with my $250 subscription to the Oxford English Dictionary? I have nothing but the memory of the question. Right. What does the word mean? Can I even remember the answer? Who does that? Who even tries to remember the answer when you can access it online quite easily? We don't even store in our brains the answers to the questions that we have because we figured out where to get the answer next time.
Right.
And so we don't clutter our brains.
It's called outsourcing your memory, Dave.
Well, and that can be a problem.
Yeah.
It's easier to access in an instant search for the word I need, and I can get it in a nanosecond. But what of the value of leafing through the pages at random? Have you ever been on a walk through the forest and just appreciated the discovery process? Call it an off-trail excursion, where you're aware of the sights, the smells, the sounds, and you're not on a trail to get from point A to point B.
Right.
It's just to enjoy the experience of it. And I think there is an enjoyment to the learning process, which is being carved out and thrown away.
Well, there's something about a process of learning that requires a little bit of investment. Dave, I'll give you an example. When you smell an older book, do you know more about that book and more about the history of books than when you just get online and look up the name of a book?
Sure. Okay. No, it goes back to this issue, Kevin. There is a process to learning. There is a way to get information. And it has a more profound and lasting impact on the person in the process of acquiring it than just doing a word search or a Google inquiry. And you're working something out in the process. And as you work it out, there's something of an intrinsic benefit that occurs. I think one of the reasons why I'm fascinated by the Oxford English Dictionary, for the same reasons that I benefited from a year's study at Oxford, and the process of learning there was very, very different. Working through primary and secondary sources and having to wrestle with concepts, having to work hard to develop a thesis and then be in a position to defend it. That whole process of learning was very critical. And actually, the same thing happened in the development of the Oxford English Dictionary. It was a process, a very long process. The guy who started it, it took him over 40 years and he never even saw the completed edition of the Oxford English Dictionary. You know, it reminds me in our conversations, because you do some celestial navigation, it reminds me of the value of the sextant. And how similarly in our society, no one needs it. No one uses it. Who needs it when you have a GPS on your phone?
But you know what's interesting? There's thinking that goes into creating a celestial fix, but there's an aesthetic to it, Dave. There's a beauty to it. When you ask a person why they would rather sail a boat than motor around, because you really don't need sails like you would in the past, most sailors would say, well, there's an aesthetic to it. There's a reason. There's an immersion into the environment. There's a requirement for thought. Celestial navigation's the same way. I've got my books out for tonight, actually, to pick out the 7 most prominent stars, preset the sextant to it, and see if I can actually see them right after the sun goes down when no one else can see anything, but my sextant will show me where that star is.
You know, your experience in sailing is going to be very different, immersed in your environment, and deeply aware of what's going on, than, say, I'm imagining a sailing trip for someone, you know, sort of lifestyles of the rich and famous, or if you wanted to borrow Veblen's theory of the leisure class. There are people who just get out of the boat and enjoy the wind in their hair and the freedom they have of sipping champagne in a carefree way. Are they immersed in their environment? No, they're not. Are they served well by a GPS? Yes, they are. And a crew to sail that boat for them? Certainly. And that may be appropriate in certain instances. But what you're describing is really what I'm describing in the process of learning from books. You don't get it all online. You can't. And what you have online is not necessarily going to always be online. Do you know how to read? Do you know how to think? In your case, do you know how to navigate? We're talking about technology allowing for a greater disconnection with events and the environment that you're in, changing the nature of your encounter, changing the nature of decision making and the actions that you take, the shifts that have to be made in our daily lives because of our dependence on technology and things being done for us, not inside a thoughtful process. The thoughtful process goes into the algorithm, and then we just assume that autopilot is sufficient. There is an experience that comes from full immersion. Experience is cheapened when you can pay to have it done and have the skills replaced by technological gizmos. Batteries run out. Software and hardware, they can fail.
Well, and just to point out, Dave, you are not anti-technology. You use technology all the time, but you just can't depend on it. You have to use your brain.
Well, that's right. So I'm sitting there in the airport wondering about the blessings and the curses of technological dependence, and it's a question of confidence in the new versus the old. Confidence in the new technology requires a special faith. It expects a hopeful outlook. I'm looking for the reliable. I'm looking for the trustworthy. I'm looking for the tried and tested and true, the timeless. I'm looking for the definitive measure of value, the bedrock of knowledge. I want a reference point that doesn't require batteries.
Right.
Perhaps this is why, in a parallel track, I'm so comfortable with gold. Gold in the monetary and financial sphere is a bedrock. It's the basis for everything else. When you come to building a library, what is the basis for everything else? Libraries are made of books. Books are made of words. To understand what a word is and what it can be, you have to have something as basic as a dictionary. To me, you're talking about real money. You're talking about, again, the standard for things.
Well, Dave, the market did reopen. Okay, technology came back. United Airlines screens came back on. The Wall Street Journal went back online. But what if it hadn't? And I guess that's the question. I'm not trying to talk about some apocalyptic end of all technology. But if it hadn't, would people have felt vulnerable the next morning?
No, I think it's just, again, Kevin, it's the question of what is the basis for things? And my reference point for money, for wealth, for the financial markets is and has been the basis for those markets for 3,000 to 5,000 years. It's been the unchangeable thing. What is a word? What is a book? What is a library? What is the basis of our understanding of these things? Again, I think as you return to the basis, there is a great degree of comfort in understanding them, in appreciating them, in surrounding yourself by them. The markets today judge books not only by their cover, but even by their relevance given their physical substance, and they're discounted because it can all be gotten on Kindle or some other handheld device. The question I was struck by sitting in the airport, and I linger over still, is this issue of dependence. Technology is not bad. It's very good, but it can create unhealthy levels of dependence. I want a reference point that doesn't require batteries.
You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com, or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.